Welcome to Reverie True Crime. Today's episode is a bonus episode. A while back, Dr. Jules asked me to come on her show, Riddle Me That True Crime, to discuss the case of Rebecca Zahow. This is part one, and I'm going to go ahead and drop part two for you guys as well. I hope you enjoy, and please go check out Riddle Me That True Crime.
Riddle Me That is a true crime podcast that deals with adult themes. Some episodes explore disturbing topics such as murder, abuse, sexual violence, drug abuse, suicide, and self-harm. Please listen at your own risk. Theories discussed in episodes may not be the opinion of the host.
Welcome back to the show, Riddlers. I'm Jules, and this is Riddle Me That True Crime. Today, I am joined by one of my favorite podcasters, Paige from Reverie True Crime. Welcome, Paige.
Hey, Jules. Thanks so much for having me. I'm very glad to be here with you to discuss this case today.
I'm so glad to have you. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about your podcast and what got you started in podcasting?
Oh, absolutely. So I've been interested in true crime, taboo, and mysterious things pretty much since I can remember. And let's just be real. I've always been a so-called outcast and weird according to society standards, but it's fine by me. So I just actually started listening to podcasts last year, and I never thought that I'd be into them or like podcasts, honestly. I just didn't really think that would be for me. So I found true crime podcasts and conspiracy theory podcasts. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, like they're okay. I might like this. So, I think I first started listening to Morbid, Sinisterhood, True Crime Obsessed. And I was also listening to a lot of the indie podcasters in our wonderful little community that we have. So honestly, when I was eventually being added into the Twitter groups with them, it was, you know, it was kind of a shock, and I was fangirling out a little bit. I was just totally not going to lie. So I'm lucky to call them some of my best friends in the world. And fortunately, you came along, and now you're like one of the biggest parts of our podcast family. And so you became quickly like a sister to me.
And oh, that's so sweet.
You inspire me so much, truly. I mean, you're an amazing writer and storyteller, and I just really enjoy your hard work, and you're just super talented. I never want you to stop. And
thank you, Paige.
You're welcome. I never want to stop either. And like, we can do this until we're 90, right?
Totally. We're definitely doing this till we're 90.
But yeah, I got off on a little tangent. But since I was very young, I was into researching things that I found interesting. And I was really into writing essays for English and doing creative writing, and I wanted to always put that into something that I was passionate about. Another passion, which was working as a veterinary assistant and technician. So, long story short, I was diagnosed with dysautonomia, and postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome is the type, and epilepsy. So basically, I'm falling apart is all that means. But so I wasn't really doing anything with my life for like so many years. But when I finally started listening to podcasts, I thought, why not give it a try? So I jumped in head first, and please don't listen to the first like 20 episodes or so. They're not great episodes, like audio quality, researching wise. I know they're not great, but it's a huge learning and growing process. But yeah, I've been putting all of my time and energy almost into podcasting, and true crime was kind of my obvious go-to since everything about it piques my interest. And if I ever have time, I do have another kind of idea that I want to start another podcast about, and it's in the realm of like pop culture, but maybe one day, because this takes up so much of my time, and I'm sure you totally get that.
Oh, I like, get that.
Yeah, trying to juggle just one podcast and life in general, it's not easy. But Yeah, my podcast is called Reverie True Crime, and it's basically me telling stories that I've researched and written about, like tragedies, and bringing awareness to cases that I don't see get talked about that much, and shining light on victims and survivors as much as possible. Sometimes it's unfortunately really difficult to find a lot of information on victims in so many cases, which is so sad. But, you know, the cases still bring awareness, and it may teach people signs to look for or make a light bulb go off, you know, in their mind and think, oh, I never thought of that. So, you know, I've done a few well-known cases, but I do like to pick ones that I haven't seen a ton. I also like to do what I call conversational interviews because I'm terrible at interviewing people.
No, you're not. I've heard your interviews. You're really good.
Jules, no way. No. I'm terrible at it.
No, you're not.
But like I had a really good time with David Thibodeau, who survived Waco. He's so great, and he's funny, and like just the spirit that these people have that I've interviewed, like Kathy Kleiner, who survived Ted Bundy. She was living in the sorority house in Florida when he broke in, and he went on a brutal rampage and killed a few of her sorority sisters. And he beat her so severely that I'm like actually very surprised that she survived it. And her spirit is just so upbeat, and it just, I don't know how people like them are just so, they're so happy, honestly. And her whole life story is about overcoming major obstacles, and she's just super strong. And our friend Eric Lindeen, who's you know, the host of the podcast True Consequences.
Great podcast, everyone.
Yes, True Consequences is great. He spoke to me about his baby brother named Jacob, who was murdered and has still not received justice, you know, after 30 some odd years. And as well as Michelle Barton, who you may also know.
Yes.
And she was telling me the story about her son, Tanner. Yeah, I have an episode coming out next month with John Allure, who is the host of Who Killed Teresa. He talked to me about his sister's murder. So those episodes where people come on the podcast and tell me their stories, those are super close to my heart, because those are different than the episodes that we research and write. It's really good to hear their survivors, or, you know, hearing from a loved one from their mouths about what they experienced. So I'm sorry, that was super long-winded.
But, no, it was good. I think it's so good to get a background. And those interviews that Paige has done with Kathy Kleiner and David Thibodeau and Eric Lindeen are really, really good. And I definitely suggest you go and check them out.
Aw, thank you.
You're welcome. So as usual, the sources are linked in the show notes. I just want to touch on something quickly. One of my listeners has let me know that I had a Spanish language ad on one of my previous episodes. I totally apologize if there are any ads that any of you find annoying. Unfortunately, since moving to Spreaker, I have no control over which ads are put in my podcast. The ads are regional, so depending upon where you are listening from, you're going to get different ads. Again, if any are problematic, please do let me know. I appreciate you reaching out and taking the time, and I do apologize for any issues regarding ads. Okay, Paige, are you ready to get into it?
Absolutely. Let's go.
This is a story of an accident in an affluent area of Coronado, California. A six-year-old boy playing on his Razor scooter would go over the second-floor banister and plunge to the ground floor, face first. His father's girlfriend would go into life-saving mode and perform CPR. The boy would be rushed to the hospital, where doctors and nurses would do everything that they could. The boy's mother and her twin sister were angry at the woman. Her boyfriend, the boy's father, insisted that the boy would have died if she hadn't performed CPR. The boy's mother and father spend most of their time at his bedside, keeping vigil. During this time, the boy's uncle arrives in town. After dinner, the brother, as well as the woman, go back to the Coronado mansion. He settles into the guest room. She goes to the main house and speaks to her sister on the phone around 11 p.m. A voicemail is left around 12:30 by the woman's boyfriend, informing her of the negative prognosis for his son. She never calls back, but phone records indicate she, or someone else with access to her phone, checks her cell phone messages. Hours later, around 6:45 a.m., the boyfriend's brother would discover her body, bound, gagged, and naked, with black paint on her breasts and a smear of blood on her thigh, hanging from the second floor spare bedroom balcony by red nautical rope. Was this a tragic suicide or was it murder? This is a story of the death of Max Shaknai and the mysterious death of Rebecca Zahal. Rebecca Zahal was born in Burma, now referred to as Myanmar, on March 15, 1979. She hailed from the Chin state. This was in the Chin Hills. The population now is around 500,000. It was decidedly less when Rebecca was born. The Chin Hills are predominantly Christian, with Christianity representing over 85% of the people who reside there. The Chin people, due to their differing religious ideologies, Burma is predominantly Buddhist, have been referred to as the Forgotten People. This is due to the fact that historically, there have been abuses and persecution, not only in Burma, but also in India as well. There continues to be ethnic and religious tensions in Burma to this day. Rebecca's parents were born-again Christians and very devout in their religious practices. Rebecca's father was very active politically, and due to rising tensions, the family decided to leave Burma. It appeared that there wasn't a solid plan in place. They, like many other families, needed to get out of the country, as their lives may depend upon it. They were forced to move around, settling in India for a period of time. This seemed like a logical move, as they simply needed to cross the border into India. The Zahal family lived there for several years before traveling to Nepal and subsequently immigrating to the United States. On a side note, I've been to Myanmar with my husband, also referred to as Burma. We went to the strangest city. It was like something out of a zombie apocalypse, spread out and barely a soul in sight. Beautiful hotels, like with nobody in them. It was so weird. It was called Napi Dao, I think is how you pronounce it. Anyways, it was run by the military, like the rest of the country. And I was like obsessed looking at online articles, just trying to figure out what is up with this city. Yeah. And yeah, there was like these articles that were saying that they had people from North Korea coming to visit and they were tunneling experts and believing that they built this like military prison underground. Isn't that crazy?
Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And there were also articles that said all the fancy hotel rooms were bugged. Like, I know this sounds absurd. What? Yeah, but it was so weird. We stayed in the Hilton and it was so nice. But I swear to God, there was like 10 people staying there. And my husband was meeting with the military. So I was like so paranoid. They're for sure listening to our conversations right now.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So like in reading those articles, it's difficult to tell what's fact and what's fiction, since there's obviously no confirmation by the government.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Right? It was like such a strange and eerie place, to say the least. Like if you're the type of person that going to see North Korea and all the strangeness that happens there, if that appeals to you, then you'd get a kick out of Napi Dao.
Yeah, you're making me like really intrigued to want to go there someday and just look, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I had like this strange anxiety the whole time I was there. I just couldn't wait to get back to Rangoon. It was just like, get me out of here.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the people in Myanmar, though, they're so wonderful, so sweet, and the food was so good. But if you do decide to visit the country, go to Yangon. Like I said, I just called it Rangoon. It's so confusing because there's two different sets of names for everything, but it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay, so I should give you a little bit of background on Myanmar, formerly Burma, which it was named until 1989. It was called Burma, then it was referred to as Myanmar. The military dictatorship wanted to shed the colonial past, and so they decided their best course of action was to rename and rebrand the country. And I know from visiting the country that many people who live there still refer to it as Burma and not Myanmar. The language is Burmese and the people are Burmese. I will refer to the country as Burma now because that was the name and the time frame I'm referencing. Prior to Rebecca's birth in 1962, there was a coup d'etat. In 1886, Burma was annexed by Britain. They received independence in 1948, and the government was a parliamentary civilian government from 1948 to 1962, up until the socialist military took over the country. This may have been due to the communist insurgency in neighboring countries. So the military jumped into action, seized power, dismantled the government, declared martial law, kicked the foreigners out, and ruled with an iron fist. This may have something to do with why the Zahal family left.
Yeah, first of all, I cannot imagine growing up and having to watch my parents fear for our lives and having to move around so much to try to find a safe haven. So I just wonder how that impacted her as a child going through that. Martial law and everything like that, that scares me. And so with everything that seemed to be going on there, it also seems to me like that would be a reason to leave.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't seem safe at that time at all. And I'm sure her parents were constantly under worry and stress. And I hurt for anyone who has to go through things like that. And I was actually surprised that she grew up Christian, because I jumped to the conclusion that she and her family were more than likely Buddhist.
It's kind of a logical thing to guess, because the majority of the country is Buddhist. So
yeah. That was very shocking to me. And I myself lean a lot towards Buddhism. And so, yeah, I was surprised about their religious beliefs. But going back to her childhood, I just can't imagine that it was easy for her parents to steadily move. And growing up in that situation just could not have been easy mentally or emotionally for any of them, I don't think.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And as far as Buddhism goes, it's usually pretty peaceful, but there is a radicalization of Buddhism that does come out of Myanmar. And there has been some issues and religious persecutions tied to other religions. So it has been problematic in the past.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, it's very ethnically diverse and quite religiously diverse, even though the vast majority of the population is Buddhist. There's, you know, pretty much all religions are represented there.
Wow. Okay. I did not know that. So that's, yeah. That's really, you're teaching me something today. I love it.
Okay. So Rebecca's family landed in America when she was around the age of 22. Most of the family would settle in and make a life for themselves in Missouri. Rebecca had at least three sisters. One, Zena, you will become familiar with as she was present during Max's accident. And the other, Mary, is a vocal advocate for her sister after her mysterious death. There is at least one other sister who lives in Germany. It is unclear exactly how many brothers and sisters that Rebecca has, since in sources it commonly lists the three sisters and then says, quote, amongst other siblings, end quote. So it's like a little confusing, right?
Right, yes.
At this point, Rebecca has spent a good portion of her life as a displaced person. It was shortly after arriving in the U.S. and moving to Scottsdale, Arizona, that Rebecca met a man, Neil Nalepa. Neil had ambitions of being a nurse, and the two quickly formed a relationship that would end in marriage in 2002. However, this wouldn't last, as the two had split up prior to Rebecca meeting Jonah Shacknai. At that point, in 2008, when the two would start dating, Rebecca was still married to Neil.
Oh, so was there any information as to why things didn't work out between Rebecca and Neil, or how they met?
Not really. I had a hard time kind of finding anything solid on, you know, if this was a great love story or if this was a marriage of kind of practicality or what.
Right. And then Jonah enters the picture. You know, I'm slightly familiar with this case, but as far, you know, as far as what happens later, I know about that and what my theory is, but I'm not exactly sure how she and Jonah met.
Oh, okay. So they met at her job at an eye clinic in Scottsdale. She enjoyed the work so much that she got the proper training to be an ophthalmic tech. It was at this optical clinic in 2008 that Jonah Shacknai would see the beautiful Rebecca Zahal for the first time. Despite a nearly two-decade age difference, the two hit it off right away.
Oh, okay. So I can't really speak much to the age difference because my fiance and I are almost that far apart in age. So, I mean, I don't think it's too bad if it's, you know, a healthy, mature, loving, and real relationship, you know?
Oh, I agree. My husband's older than I am. I think that age is nothing but a number, for sure.
Right. Yeah. And you have to be in it for the right reasons, because I know not everyone gets into those huge age gap relationships for the right reasons, whether it's like the older person's looking for someone young and, you know, someone that's pleasing to their eyes and pleasuring their sexual needs and, you know, just being their arm candy, basically. And then you sometimes have the younger person looking for a sugar mama or a sugar daddy or something like that, or materialistic and money. So, yeah, but not every relationship is like that.
No, it's true. And it doesn't seem like this relationship was like that. It seemed that age was like, really, like I said, it was nothing but a number for these two. They were both really attractive, both into physical fitness. They were both into healthy eating. And Jonah was really taken with Rebecca. Like, obviously, she was beautiful. She was really sweet, warm, and she was exotic in that she'd been a world traveler, like just as he had, but for entirely different reasons. They'd both traveled all around the world. He is a wealthy millionaire or billionaire CEO of Medicis Pharmaceutical, and she, Rebecca, as a displaced person from her native Burma. Jonah was taken with Rebecca's warmth and creativity. She expressed herself in a very open way, often hugging her friends and always smiling. Rebecca also used to love to paint, draw, and write. She was very gifted in the arts.
Well, everything, you know, so far seems to be starting off really well. He was attracted to her personality and her creativity, and those are definitely great things to admire and love about a person. So, personally, I love the fact that she was so creative. People that are talented in arts and crafts, they just really amaze me, because I've tried to dabble in painting and drawing, and I don't have the skill sets for either of those things. So I love being around creative people that can do that. So I can see like how that's super romantic to somebody, and that could make him like so much more attractive to her, because I feel like that's really sexy about somebody if they have like a creative thing that they're passionate about. So Rebecca also seemed to be such a sweet and caring soul, you know, so I'm sure they had talks about their totally different traveling experiences. And I would think having those deep conversations would create a strong bond, even though he had deep pockets. She seems like she's very much a person that is a free spirit, and she wouldn't be attracted to someone because of their wealth, I don't think. You know, if she liked you or loved you, I think that it was extremely genuine.
I agree. I think Rebecca was like a really warm, caring person. She didn't seem like a superficial person in the way that any of her friends described her.
Right.
Yeah. And the couple shared a love for all things outdoors. They liked to hike, bike, and go boating on occasion. They were both very committed, as I mentioned, to their physical fitness, and they both put a great deal of effort into eating healthy. They took their health and physical appearance to heart. They seemed like an ideal match on the surface.
Yeah, sharing things in common and doing things together that you both love is a great feeling. And I think it's wonderful that they had that, but at the same time, we don't always know what people experience in their homes behind closed doors. So I always wonder when people are like that in public or show pictures on social media of what they portray to be this happy life together, if that passion and fun and happiness is truly going on when nobody's looking.
I think sometimes when you see like those couples or people who post everything, and it's like this perfectly curated life where everyone's so happy and like they're constantly posing photos. Oh, I love you so much. Like blah, blah, blah. And like, it's so much like Shanann and Chris Watts, you know what I mean? Like that sort of, where sometimes there's something else going on that causes people to feel the need to put this curated perfect life out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Jonah Shacknai, he seems like a nice guy. And in some sources, he's said to be a millionaire and others a billionaire. So I was kind of unable to figure out his exact net worth because it varies. But in any event, he was extremely wealthy. Medicis Pharmaceuticals was worth billions. And their claim to fame was Restylane, an injectable filler that is thought to rival Botox, though each does entirely different things. Botox paralyzes facial muscles while Restylane fills in wrinkles.
You know, I don't judge if people choose to get Botox or want to fill in their wrinkles or anything people want to do to their own bodies. That's 100% their business. And whatever makes you feel good about yourself, do that. But it's like going back to when you said they were very much into being healthy and in shape, which I'm not saying is a bad thing at all, but they seem to be focused a lot on their bodies and how they look, which in some cases can turn into, you know, unhealthy situations. But my point is basically Jonah seems to be very much into what society deems as a good looking person and possibly staying as youthful in his appearance as he can. And at the same time, selling a product that, you know, gets rid of wrinkles, which I personally love those so-called flaws, but it just brings it full circle, in my opinion, about him being very appearance focused, possibly. Just my speculation, maybe.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of focus put on the exterior. And I think what you said, it can go both ways. People can be really focused on healthy eating and being physically active, not for physical appearance reasons, but because they're very in tune with their bodies, their mind, their spirit. But there's usually another component to that, where somebody will usually be really into yoga or be into meditation. Mm-hmm. We don't necessarily see that here, but Rebecca is very in touch with her creative side. So that's kind of in the same vein as like meditation and yoga.
Right, right.
We don't see that with Jonah.
That's what I speculate, kind of. Like he may be in it for like the wrong reasons, like his job and doing all the healthy things. I feel like it's more about the appearance to him.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see your perspective on that. Jonah had a beautiful home in Scottsdale, where Medisa's Pharmaceuticals was based. He also had a luxurious vacation home on Coronado, the Spreckles Mansion. This was a famous home that was worth millions of dollars. I will give you some background and history on the mansion, because it's kind of interesting. Spreckles was a former home of sugar magnate Adolph B. Spreckles and his wife Alma, as well as industrialist John Spreckles, who was the force behind the project. John Spreckles was the owner of the Union Daily Paper, as well as the Tribune. He built the mansion after experiencing an earthquake in San Diego. He built it with steel-reinforced concrete to withstand any natural disaster. The major architectural undertaking by famed architect Harrison Albright was completed in 1908. It boasted 4 bedrooms, 6 baths, and was well over 6,000 square feet. The interior shots of the home from when the couple had been living there during vacations shows dated interiors with thick shag-like carpet. It was no doubt a beautiful home. It was just like not exactly what I pictured when I saw the price tag. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
You should Google it. It's just, they've updated it now, but I think at the time, it just, the interior looked like it was like 1980s interior or something like that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's really interesting. I can't wait to Google it and look at it.
Yeah. So there's limited real estate in Coronado, and the Spreckles Mansion was right across from the beach, like obviously an ideal location. Some sources say at one point, John Spreckles owned all of the Coronado Peninsula.
Oh my gosh, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. I love hearing how and when homes were built. And like I said, I can't wait to see pictures of what the inside of the mansion looked like at that time that they were staying there. I never looked that up, so it will be interesting to see. But it must be really nice to be able to afford a place like that. You know, I'll never know that feeling, but the description of this place definitely does sound like what I had pictured in my mind. I had something completely different in my mind about what, you know, I thought it may have looked like. When you hear mansion, I guess it just doesn't ring like shag carpet or like any of that. Any of those bells were not going off.
Yeah, I guess like modern interiors and updating, you know, the vacation home wasn't the top of the list for Jonah, I'm assuming.
Yeah, for sure.
So he'd been married twice before he and Rebecca met in Scottsdale. His marriage to his first wife, Kimberly James, had resulted in 2 children. Kimberly and Jonah were for a time embroiled in a bitter custody dispute that took nearly 3 years to resolve. Can you imagine?
No, that's frustrating. That's crazy.
Jonah then married Dina Romano, with whom he shared a son, Max, who was 3 years old at the time the couple began to date in 2008. Rebecca was closer in age to Jonah's children from the first marriage and reportedly didn't spend a great deal of time with them. Rebecca and Max, however, did form a very special bond. Like, in looking at photos of the two of them together, they're both glowing. This isn't a woman who's putting on a smile. This is a woman who is genuinely happy to be spending time with this little boy.
Yeah. You know, it's always awkward, I think, when you're with someone who's been married before or who has children, you know, just with another person. My fiance is divorced and he's got a teenager. He's 16. It's crazy. And I'm almost the exact same age difference between his son and him. And so we joke about that a lot. But thankfully, we don't have any drama, you know, in our situation at all. And I really actually want to meet her one day, of course. And, you know, that's his mother. So, of course, I want to have a good relationship with her. I think it's good to have that healthy relationship with the other parent when you're with their ex.
Yeah. If it's a kid that's a teenager or a small child, I agree. I think it's great if you can.
Yeah. You know, I've been in relationships before. This one guy, he was totally abusive, but I think because he had two girls that were 5 years old, it made me, it just made it so much harder to want to leave because I was super attached to them and I didn't want to feel like I was abandoning them and I didn't want them to feel that way about me either. So
that's awful.
Yeah, but I can just imagine the love and the care that Rebecca had towards Max, probably instantly. You know, there's some instances where the mother or the father of the children, whether it's the ex or the person you're dating, they get jealous if they see their child is bonding a lot with you more than they seem to be spending time with their biological parent.
Oh, definitely.
So, yeah, and that's when things get really weird because you know, you love the child and you cherish that bond, but the ex or your partner, or maybe even both of them, can get really envious of that relationship, which, I mean, it's understandable to a point, but it's important to be happy that your child is happy and loved. I mean, it really doesn't mean that the child loves their parent any less. I think people just get in their feelings way too much.
Yeah, I agree. Like, as a child of divorce, my parents were awful and they both got remarried. And then, of course, the step parents and the parents hate each other and there's jealousy. And it just is miserable for children.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. You're only making it like really hard on the kids when you don't get along with each other. And
so there was trouble in paradise at times, as Dina and Jonah had a rocky divorce and sharing custody with Max was problematic at times. However, for their son, they did the best they could to be cordial. For his part, Jonah bought Dina a Coronado home. It was located just down the street from Spreckles' mansion. This way, the couple could easily send Max back and forth between homes. This would cause far less disruption to the little boy's life. The Spreckles' mansion was purchased by Jonah and Dina when they were married. And Dina fondly remembers Max going up to the room that would be his, eyes wide, and asking if he got to live here. If this would be his room. Isn't that the cutest?
Oh my gosh. I love kids. They're so cute. Oh, the things they say just melt your heart.
I know. Max seemed like a little boy who just loved life and was so excited to be outside, to be with his dog Ocean, and to spend time with his parents, as well as his father's girlfriend, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Like, I can see why, right? She was active and she was energetic and she loved to play with Max.
Yeah. Yeah. And what kid wouldn't love that? Like, they've got a new best friend, you know?
Exactly. And sources say the two were very close. At times, as we mentioned, this caused a rift with Dina, according to Rebecca's sister, Mary, who said that Dina would get angry at the fact that Max would sometimes choose to hang out with Rebecca over her. Like, I mean, I do get it. My stepmom was way younger than my mom. And in some ways, I related to her more. Though she was never a replacement for my real mother. She was just different.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely not because the child is replacing their parent with someone else. And I completely understand and try to place myself in other shoes as much as I can. As far as, you know, I don't have any children, but I feel the jealousy needs to be controlled. You know, attempt to understand that your child has basically made another friend, especially at five. The little ones that are extroverts and they don't meet a stranger, and the ones that warm up to people easily, they're not thinking, you know, this is now my mom and you don't matter to me anymore. That's, you know, kids don't think like that. They're just having, you know, a good time with a cool friend, you know, and they're just having fun. And I think the reality of what's happening gets clouded by our personal feelings sometimes. And that's when we need to take a step back, analyze the situation, and hopefully come to that realization that what's really taking place here, you know, I think our feelings just, we get into them way too much sometimes, and I'm guilty of it too, but I also try to recognize that it's not healthy. You know, I do my best to remember to take a breath, take a step back, get out of my emotions, clear my mind so that I can assess an issue that I'm having in a proper way. Because running solely on your emotions is never good. It's never good to do that.
I think the fact that you can actually recognize when you're in your feelings too much and you're having one of those moments, mm-hmm. I can take a step back and remove yourself. I think that's extremely adult of you, Paige.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I try. Now, I don't always, you know, succeed, but I try.
So even though Rebecca was dating Jonah, this wealthy CEO, she kept her job at the optical clinic. She had two really good girlfriends who worked with her at the clinic, and the patients reportedly loved Rebecca. They would often hug her upon arrival and when they left. Rebecca had this way. She was so disarming. People who witnessed this, who work at the clinic with her, said she was absolutely magnetic and that she just drew people into her orbit. They all wanted to be close to the sense of warmth and kindness that kind of exuded from Rebecca. There's one incident of note that's curious. If it is relevant to the story is up for debate, as it may speak to the mental health struggles Rebecca could have been experiencing as early as 2009. At a Macy's in Phoenix, Arizona, 1 year after she'd started dating Jonah Shacknai, Rebecca had tried to shoplift around $1,000 worth of jewelry. Everyone close to her wondered why. Jonah surely would have purchased these items for her if she wanted them. What would have compelled her to steal them?
Well, from the picture that everyone paints of Rebecca, she truly was a light in this world, and we all need someone like that around us, even if it's at a doctor's appointment and someone who works there, you know, is so kind and warm, and, you know, that really makes your day so much better. And I definitely know she did that for people, and she probably didn't even know that that person needed a hug or a smile that day. But, you know, as far as her stealing, this is my opinion, and opinions are scary to put out there because everyone has their own, and I respect that about others, and I only, you know, want people to hear me out and respect mine as well. I tend to ponder about how she grew up with maybe not absolutely nothing, but not a lot that she could call her own. And sure, Jonah could have bought her anything that she wanted, but possibly she wanted to have something that she could just call her own. You know, even though stealing is wrong, and I don't promote that at all, I'm not saying stealing is right, but when people steal, sometimes, you know, it's people often steal when they've never been able to buy something, often expensive and sometimes not expensive at all. They just know that they don't have the money for it. And they think to themselves, you know, I got this. This is mine. And nobody else had to get this for me. It's sad, but it's also the truth in a lot of instances. And I know not everyone steals things for that reason, but maybe she just wanted something nice that she could call her own and not have to rely on a man or someone else to get it for. I can't know that for sure. And one thing is, you know, a lot of abusers do withhold money from their partners as punishment. So again, I don't know if that's what's going on here. You know, there's a lot that we could speculate about that. But what about you? What's your theory on the stealing?
I don't know. Like, there was at one point Mary, Rebecca's sister, who said, like, after all of this happened, that Jonah wasn't going to give her an allowance for a really long time. So it kind of goes along with what you're saying in that potentially he could have withheld money because he was unhappy with her. So he could have potentially used money as an instrument of control within the relationship.
Yeah, and not giving her an allowance, that's exactly kind of, that's odd.
And it's kind of a big thing because Rebecca was very generous and very committed to helping her family. She would save $400 from every single paycheck, and she sent it to her parents in Missouri. Her parents, like, they counted on this money from Rebecca to make ends meet and support her other siblings. So I don't know. I think this was likely the primary motivation for Rebecca keeping her job, despite dating a millionaire or billionaire. Perhaps she wanted to maintain a sense of identity separate from Jonah as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. You know, I feel in my heart that she was like, this is my family. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to take care of them. And I don't want anyone else's money to do it. I want my money that I earned to be the reason that they're financially able to make it. You know, there's a sense of pride there that I understand that fully. And I've never wanted anyone to buy me anything. I've always been that person that's never wanted anyone's money. Some people have called me stubborn about it, but I just call it being strong-willed and independent. But, you know, if my family needs anything and they're depending on me, I always feel like that's for me to handle and not anyone else. So, you know, I always feel awkward when people buy presents for me on my birthday or Christmas. And that's just how weird I am about people spending money on me. So I get the feeling that she was determined to help her family on her own. You know, even if I was with a billionaire, I see myself being the exact same way, to be honest, because I've always had that attitude of, I really don't want your money. Please don't do X, Y, or Z. I'll get it done. I'll find a way. You know, everything will be fine. I've always been like that.
Well, I think maybe Rebecca was like that initially, but eventually Jonah wore her down and she quit her job at the optical clinic after about 3 years of dating. Jonah had wanted Rebecca to be able to travel to Coronado with him and Max for the summer and not have to worry about returning to a job. Rebecca was reticent initially. She had her parents and family to worry about, right?
Yeah.
And they relied on this money that she sent home from her paychecks. Jonah had told Rebecca, don't worry about it. If her decision was contingent upon the support money for her parents, then it wasn't a problem. He would send the money to her parents every month. Rebecca agreed, and in December 2010, she quit her job to spend more time with Jonah and Max.
I mean, I'm sure that was an extremely stressful and difficult decision for her to make, because I would think that she would have struggled a lot within herself to finally agree to let him do that for her and her family. Especially when you're raised a certain way, it's hard to break away from, you know, even a tiny piece of how you've been raised. Especially if it's something that you really believe in and it's important to you. You know, she may have had a hard time with that, but at the same time, I mean, I'm absolutely sure she desired to be with Jonah and Max as much as she could. So, you know, sometimes we have to make that sacrifice of our pride and let others help us, even if it's not easy.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the predicament that Rebecca was found in. But like, as we'll see later on in text messages and things written by Rebecca, this wasn't a time of relaxation and happiness. There was potentially some depression or some anxiety that resulted from her quitting her job, which I think is pretty natural.
Yeah, for sure.
Her friends from the eye clinic said that once Rebecca quit, they rarely saw her or heard from her. It seemed she was becoming more involved in Jonah's world and was potentially losing some of her own friends and her own interests. There had to have been some stress as well, like knowing that she didn't have the commitment from Jonah. They weren't married and there wasn't a ring on her finger. If they were to break up, Rebecca would be left with nothing, right?
Yeah. And, you know, and that's another thing about her quitting her job and just like going completely off with him, that if they did break up, you know, I'm sure she had to know and think about that fact that she wouldn't have anything, anywhere to go even.
Exactly. And like, who would take care of her parents? This was evidenced in her text messages at the time. Like, this was clearly weighing on her. There was also something else going on, in that Rebecca says that no amount of money is worth what she is enduring or going through. Like, I have no idea exactly what she's referencing here. We can only speculate. But no matter how one chooses to look at it, it doesn't look good, does it?
No, that doesn't look good at all.
No. Those close to her seemed to think that she felt that she had a lot more invested in this relationship than Jonah did, and that she was used to being the one who was adored, pursued, and loved more emphatically by her partner. And in this relationship, that she was the one who was loving Jonah more and giving him more attention, and he was kind of more withdrawn and more cold.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking as... You know, to the first part of it, being depressed and having anxiety, I also deal with that. And I can, you know, only imagine how, you know, she was feeling after she gave up her job. And maybe she felt like she was letting her family down in some way. And I'm just trying to put myself, you know, in her position in my mind. And I would feel really bad about it, you know, if I were her, probably. I would shut down and be quiet for days. And, you know, on top of that, she's feeling like, you know, she loves Jonah more than he loves her. And that's an awful feeling in itself.
Oh my gosh, it's so terrible. We've all been there before.
Yeah. And like we were talking about, if they break up, she'll have nothing and nowhere to go. And who's going to take care of her family? And that just had to be difficult for her or anybody else in her situation to process, really. So, you know, especially people who are really sensitive. I feel like she was probably a really sensitive person. But, you know, when people are sensitive and have depression and anxiety already, that's going to be a terrible time until you can find a way to work through all of those mental and emotional hurdles.
Well, it's made even more difficult when you've got a partner who isn't tapped into their own emotions or your emotions. That's difficult.
Yeah, for sure. That's just, yeah, it's hard.
In July, Rebecca, Jonah, and 6-year-old Max had been staying on the Coronado Peninsula at Spreckles Mansion. Also staying at the mansion was Rebecca's 13-year-old sister, Zena. On July 11th, Jonah, who was very committed to his physical fitness, as we've said throughout, had told Rebecca that he was going to pop into the gym. And could she watch Max? Rebecca agrees, but remember, Max is 6, he's not 2. Rebecca likely didn't have to have her eye on him every second of the day. When I was 6, I would walk home to an empty house, make myself some food before my parents came home several hours later. So this doesn't sound crazy to me.
Yeah, it's not unrealistic in any way that someone is going to stare at a 6-year-old's every move like you would a baby. I'm an only child, and I admit that, you know, we live in the countryside, and I ran around our house outside without a care in the world, and nobody really batted an eye about it because that's just what most kids did. We played outside while our parents were being adults, you know, talking on the phone about things they didn't want us to hear, or, you know, just wanted us to be out of their hair. You know, they would always say, go outside and play. And I heard a lot of that at 5 and 6 years old. So nobody really thought through the dangers maybe back then that could have happened. Especially though, if I was in the house, nobody was going to be watching me like a hawk, you know, checking in every once in a while to see what I was up to. You know, if I got too quiet, sure, because when kids are quiet, it's usually, you know, because they're doing something they're not supposed to be. But yeah, I completely agree with you. That was something that was not unheard of or wild that an adult, you know, wouldn't watch every step at that age. And I think a lot of us knew what we were and were not supposed to do around that age too.
Yeah. Like I remember being 6 and I was extremely independent. So I mean, I could understand Max playing by himself. And like you, I was an only child until I was like 9 years old. So you spend a lot of time playing on your own, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So Rebecca at the time had reportedly been blow drying her hair on the bottom floor bathroom. Zena had been taking a shower on the second floor, and Max was playing with his razor scooter. At some point that morning, something tragic happened. Max would go over the banister, scooter and all. He would grasp at the chandelier and take a tumble to the ground floor, hitting his head and landing face first. Rebecca, upon hearing the sound, screams at her sister Zena to call 911 to get help for Max. Police and EMTs arrive, and luckily Rebecca has been trained in CPR, and she managed to keep Max alive. Like at this point, the police are trying to get a clear picture as to what happened here. Why was Max laying on the floor and what had caused this accident? Rebecca seemed unable to give them a straight answer. She was clearly in shock.
Yeah, we can never predict these types of things will happen ever. I know that this, you know, was a tragic accident, and I in no way in my heart mean this in any kind of disrespectful way or anything like that, but accidents happen. I won't even get into all the things that have happened to me, breaking my bones. My little cousins have broken bones. And I think everyone has a few of those stories about really bad accidents that could have turned out to be fatal even. You know, nobody can know that these things are going to happen. And it's sad and it's heartbreaking. And knowing the child was in your care when it happened, that's guilt that you'll always carry.
Oh my gosh, yes. That would be so awful.
Yeah. I mean, I can't help but to bring up personal experiences because there are so many things that I can relate to and oddly feel this connection to her, which probably sounds really weird.
No, it doesn't sound weird. I feel that connection to her too. I think she's just an extremely relatable person.
Yeah, I feel like I relate to her. And when my cousin was just learning how to walk, I literally only turned my head for 2 seconds to throw my hair up in a ponytail. And while I was almost finished, I heard a giant crash. And it was all in slow motion. I saw it out of the side of my eye, but there was no way I could have possibly moved as fast as I would have needed to stop it. And he was basically holding onto a shelf that had breakables and pictures, and not to mention this particular shelf was almost as tall like as going up to the ceiling. So I'm watching him fall backwards, and I'm watching the shelf fall on top of him, and 20 or 30 of these huge and small breakable objects just shattering on the floor, and I'm screaming. He never made a sound, and I thought he was actually dead, to be completely honest. And I was in hysterics.
Oh my gosh,
and knowing that that happened on my watch, that was really hard. And that guilt is something that I completely can understand. But yeah, I did lift the shelf up off of him, and he didn't have a single scar, scratch, nick, cut, or anything. I mean, I swear there was an angel there that day, because I've never seen something like that and thought, oh my gosh, you know, he could be dead. Like, I had never gone through anything like that. Like, what do I do? I was petrified. And so I was having a panic attack, but I finally did walk over there and I took the shelf off of him, and I saw that he was breathing. I saw that he was blinking, and my mom was in the other room. So she heard it and she came running, and she was helping me move everything. And we, looked at him like he was fine. I just couldn't believe it. He was 100% okay. And he never even cried. I just think he was in complete shock, but I couldn't even face anybody. You know, I stayed in my room for like hours going through a full-blown panic attack, even knowing at that point that he was okay. So, I mean, I can almost guarantee you that Rebecca didn't forgive herself for it. And I know she felt guilt about it, you know, and I don't fault her. She had the blow dryer on. She couldn't know that he was on the scooter. And I'm sure the last time she checked on him, he was doing something really mundane. And, you know, it doesn't take but 1 second for something to happen. And I don't know anyone in my real life who hasn't, you know, had something like that similar happen, because kids are going to be kids and accidents are going to happen. And sometimes they're really bad. Unfortunately, but it's not always our fault, because we can't control everything in the world.
No, it's true. And accidents do happen. Like, I remember dropping my brother on his head when he was a baby, and I felt so bad because I was 9, right? It wasn't like I was, in my 20s, and I felt so bad. I thought like, oh my God, I've ruined him. I've broken the baby.
Yeah.
But he was okay. And, you know, I remember my stepmom saying at the time, like, it's okay. Like, these things happen. You know, it wasn't like I just dropped him literally on his head. I dropped him and he fell a distance when I was sitting. It wasn't like I held him up really high and dropped him on his head. But still, you feel really guilty. Like, what if he dies? What if this happens? You know, when you're nine, you don't know. And so I completely understand Rebecca's guilt here. She didn't do anything on purpose, but she didn't have her eye on him every second, which wouldn't have been a problem had this not happened. So Max had fallen face first onto the ground. This resulted in head injuries and spinal cord injuries. Had Rebecca not performed CPR, Max likely would have died at the scene. During questioning, Rebecca tells authorities that Max was conscious at one point and said one word, Ocean, the name of the family dog. This will be later called into dispute by pathologist Dr. Judy Melnick, who asserts it would have been impossible for Max to have uttered this word given the scope of his injuries. Many experts question if Rebecca fabricated this or was simply confused and traumatized by the events of the day. I have no feelings one way or the other here, and I am obviously not a medical professional.
Yeah, I mean, I could only guess that she was so traumatized by this that maybe, you know, she thought she heard that, or maybe she truly did hear it. I mean, I don't feel like Rebecca was the type of person that would lie about something like that. I mean, I truly don't. When you're experiencing something that traumatic, I can only speculate that she told the truth of what she believed that she heard. You know, I don't know if anyone can say, you know, like, oh, hey, I know for sure he didn't say that. You know, I can't, you know, you don't know if he said ocean or not. You know, people can do remarkable things under the craziest circumstances that you think they can't. So I don't know, the human body is just such a complex thing. And sometimes, you know, things happen and doctors get it wrong. So I can only speak from my own experiences and what I feel. And I don't think that Rebecca made it up. Either it really happened or it didn't, you know, but I don't think she was lying about what she thought she heard.
Yeah, I don't think she maliciously fabricated everything. I think if it didn't happen, she was just confused, traumatized, and in shock from the events. Maybe she saw ocean nearby and somehow got it confused that Max had said the word ocean amidst all the chaos. I'm not sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Police check the scene at Sparkle's mansion, and everything is lining up with an accident. There's paint missing from the second floor banister, and it lines up with paint on the Razor scooter that was found beside Max. This appears to have been a tragic accident, and that Rebecca likely wasn't watching Max at the time, so it's possible that that's the primary reason she wasn't able to articulate a proper retelling of events, because she simply wasn't there to witness exactly what happened.
Yeah, that's what I think. I don't think she was there to see it happen, and that doesn't make her a bad person. I mean, like I said, you never expect these freak accidents to happen. And had she been in the same room or knew what he was doing, I think she would have told him not to ride his scooter in the house, or she would have done anything in her power to save him when he fell. As mentioned, she, you know, she ran right over and did CPR as soon as she saw him. So, you know, she always put others before herself, and she definitely would have laid her own life down on the line for Max or anybody else, in my opinion.
From everything I've heard of Rebecca, like, I hold her in extremely high regard, like you said. Like, I think she's somebody who put others first, and she cared a great deal about other people, especially Max.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know she loved him.
Yeah, like looking at the pictures of the two of them, it's so clear that Rebecca treated him as if he was her own son and that this would have been devastating for her.
Definitely.
So Rebecca calls Jonah to tell him about what happened to Max. At this point, Jonah's still at the gym. He quickly jumps into action and calls his ex-wife Dina, Max's mother. Dina is irate when she realizes that Max wasn't home with his father at the time of the accident, and that Max was being watched by his father's girlfriend, 32-year-old Rebecca Zahau. Jonah quickly jumps to Rebecca's defense, insisting this wasn't Rebecca's fault and that this was simply an accident. Jonah even adds in that it was Rebecca's swift reaction and ability to perform CPR that likely saved Max's life, saying Dina should be thanking Rebecca and not angry with her. Dina is unconvinced, which is understandable. She's the mother, and of course, if this happened to your child, you would need someone to blame. This is totally natural, in my opinion.
Yeah. And Jonah, you know, he was thinking in a rational manner, and he said what I believe were the right things to say. And I believe that it was the absolute truth. You still have that new girlfriend versus the ex-wife and mother of Max drama or tension going on. And, you know, Dina is still wallowing in her jealousy on top of everything. So if that were my kid, I'm sure that I would be outraged, you know, maybe worse. I don't think it would be easy to think rationally when you find something like that out about your own child. And she has a right to her feelings, but at the same time, at some point, you again have to try your best to get out of your personal feelings and analyze the situation. So, you know, Rebecca did CPR. She did all that she could to save him. And as you said, Dina needed somebody to blame and release her hurt onto in that moment. And Rebecca was just the easiest target for that.
I don't even think like it was intentional. And I don't even think it had anything to do with the jealousy at this point. I think it was just, it wasn't rational. Grief isn't always rational, right? And she's just so upset by the situation. And Rebecca is the easiest person to blame. If it wasn't her, it would have been Jonah.
Yeah. Yeah, whoever was at the house at that time, that's who she would have blamed. So
exactly. Like, my heart goes out to Dina in this situation. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like having to hear this news about your six-year-old child.
Yeah, it had to be absolutely heartbreaking and gut-wrenching. And, you know, like I said, I probably would have been outraged too. You know, when you're not thinking rationally and you're just, all you can think is of, oh my God, you know, she let this happen.
Yeah, I don't think that it's like rational and logical thought at that point. I think it's just anger and disbelief and grief and all of these things kind of commingling together. And Yes. They're not always expressed in a healthy way.
Yeah, I agree.
So Jonah and Dina rush to the hospital. Rebecca calls her sister Mary and lets her know that Zena is going home early and will be driving her to the airport, as well as picking up Jonah's brother, tugboat captain Adam Shacknai. Mary said that during this time, Rebecca was exceedingly worried about the reaction of Dina and that she kept saying, Dina is going to kill me. Some people who look at this case believe that that's Rebecca acting guilty. Why would she have this guilt if she wasn't directly responsible for what happened to Max? I firmly disagree. I think that if I were in a similar situation, even if I was in another wing of the house and wasn't directly responsible, I would still be consumed with guilt over this happening to the six-year-old child of my boyfriend. Like, what do you think, Paige?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I don't understand how anyone could think that she wouldn't have guilt unless she was guilty. That, you know, she would never, in my opinion, do anything to anyone, especially a child, especially Max. You know, after all, he was in her care when it happened. So, of course, she's going to feel the guilt. And the story I told you about earlier, it still eats me alive. So I can't imagine if what I felt was actually magnified. Like, I'm sure she felt more guilt than I, because the situation that she was faced with was much different. And I absolutely cannot imagine the weight of guilt that she felt at all.
Yeah, I can't imagine just the idea that this child that you love so much might die. And it's not your child. It's your boyfriend and his ex-wife's child. Like, that just, it magnifies it for sure.
Yeah.
And then we have another problem for Rebecca. Dina's twin sister, Nina, has now arrived at Children's Hospital as well. They are pressing Jonah for details on exactly what happened. Why did Max fall? And why wasn't Rebecca watching out for him? The twins are confused and extremely bothered by the vague answers given by Rebecca. It seems clear that they both wanted to speak to Rebecca and get to the bottom of what happened that morning in the Spreckles mansion.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable to want answers, and it's understandable to be upset and angry. However, if they would just try to put themselves in Rebecca's shoes for 5 seconds, you know, she's not a perfect person, and none of us are. So I understand that they want to talk to her, but if they do and she's unable to give clear answers, you have to, you know, understand that in a traumatic situation, even after the fact, it's hard to speak. It's hard to remember what you did see or did hear. And these are things that they wanted answers to. But if that person doesn't have the answers, it's not easy on that person that was there who probably feels like it's all their fault.
And I think that empathy is a difficult thing. Like for them to step into her shoes at that point in time, I think you're just more angry than able, than even like capable of empathy. I think you just want somebody to blame. It's irrational. And it's just a knee-jerk emotional reaction that I think over time, Dina definitely was able to see Rebecca's side of things. It's just the way that things unfolded was really unfortunate because like, I can understand why Rebecca was totally swerving them. I would be scared too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I definitely agree and think, you know, in the heat of the moment, you definitely aren't even thinking about putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. But, you know, I just wish that was how it was, but that's not really, I guess, realistic. But that's just, you know, I wish people, instead of getting angry, you know, but that was a really, really huge situation. So I can understand that there was more anger and upset going on. And yeah, it's kind of unrealistic for me to think that they would try to put herself like in her shoes just for a second. So
I think she does over time, but I think just the initial reactions, our initial emotional reactions are rarely ever logical.
Yeah, that's true.
So meanwhile, Rebecca's doing everything she can to be helpful, while trying not to insert herself into the family's time of grief at the hospital. She knows that Dina is very angry and wants to give Jonah and Dina time alone with Max. Rebecca loves Max very much, but clearly doesn't want to overstep her boundaries, according to her sister Mary. Instead of going to the hospital, she drives her sister Zena to the airport and picks up Jonah's brother Adam Shackney. The two of them drive to meet Jonah for dinner. Everyone is exhausted and emotional, and there isn't much of an exchange of conversation. Jonah isn't planning on returning to Spreckles Mansion. He's going to be staying at Ronald McDonald House across from the hospital to stay close to Max. After the three finish dinner, they part ways. Rebecca and Adam drive back to Spreckles Mansion. Adam settles into the guest house, and Rebecca calls her sister Mary around 11 p.m. The two women talk for a while, possibly around 30 minutes. Rebecca seems upset and racked with guilt over what happened to Max, which is only natural. This child that she loves so much is gravely injured, and on some level, Rebecca feels responsible. I can't imagine what she must have been enduring emotionally at this time. Her sister Mary said that Rebecca had plans to wake up early around 5 a.m. and told her to tell their mother that she would call around 6 a.m. and update her on the situation. The sisters hang up the phone around 11:30 p.m. Around this time, Rebecca has a shower. At 12:30 a.m., Jonah calls Rebecca and tells her that Max will likely never walk or talk again if he survives. He doesn't get Rebecca, so he leaves a message on her voicemail. And he tells her that prognosis is negative. There's a high likelihood that Max will succumb to his injuries. Someone checks this message an hour later, potentially Rebecca or possibly Adam. We cannot be sure.
Yeah, I'm going to say that if Rebecca had seen that message, I think she would have responded, or if she had heard the voicemail. I don't really have any doubt in my mind about that. I don't think she was the one that actually checked that message. And I have some strong beliefs when it comes to these pieces of the events that took place, and not everyone's going to agree, and that's fine. But you know, we can all only speculate these things anyway, and I'm not saying that I'm right at all, but I'm just saying what I believe in my heart, that if she would have heard that, thinking about how she is as a person, I feel like she would have responded to that.
I 100% agree. I think she's such a warm and caring person, and knowing that Jonah is in such distress, I think that she would have called him back and consoled him.
Uh-huh. I do too.
So it is believed that one of two things happens next. Either Rebecca is surprised by an intruder, possibly Adam. There is a bath towel found on the floor. Next to it, several drops of blood, as Rebecca was menstruating. And her cell phone is found beside the bath towel. The intruder, potentially Adam Shackney, then binds her limbs, gags her, fetches a rope, paints a message on the door, sexually assaults her, and then wipes down fingerprints from the room. We will say allegedly because this has never been proven in criminal court.
Yeah, allegedly.
Allegedly. I said potentially, but also allegedly. Mm-hmm. Or Rebecca decides, due to this very upsetting message and the negative prognosis for Max, that she decides to take her own life. These two scenarios we will go over and over throughout. What we do know for sure is sometime around 6:45 a.m., Adam Shacknight calls 911 in what is a bizarre call to many. I will insert the call here.
I got a girl hung herself.
Okay, sir, is she still alive?
You're alive.
Well, the last time you saw her?
Last night.
Okay, is she beyond help?
I'm compressing her chest right now.
Okay, hold on.
Okay, what's
your name?
Adam Shacknight.
Okay, listen to me. Help is coming right now.
So this wasn't the full 911 call. It's only a portion because a good portion of the full call is quite garbled.
I have gone over and over this 911 call, and I find so many things suspicious about it. I know a lot of people will argue that we don't know what we would do in that situation, but what I do know is there are some common sense things that I'm almost certain people would have done immediately that he didn't do, which disturbs me. There's just a lot in this 911 call alone, especially if you listen to it a few times, that is just so off. And when we get to the details of the scene, I ask everyone to go back and listen to the call again, because I think you might hear some things that maybe you didn't catch the first time.
Yeah, Paige is right. It's something you want to listen to maybe three or four times, because each subsequent time you listen, it gets stranger and stranger, right?
Yeah, and especially when you find out the details later and then you go back and listen to it, it's like, whoa, wait a minute.
I'm really troubled by the fact that Adam says, I got a girl here, not my brother's girlfriend or Rebecca. He seems to be distancing himself from any connection to her.
Yes, because he absolutely knows what her name is. And so just to say, I got a girl here.
Just had dinner with her the night before. He knows her.
Yes. And I don't know if it was just me. I don't know if you picked up on this or maybe heard this, but there seems to me that there were two voices I heard at one point, and I kept replaying it, and it does have like a staticky noise and everything, so it wasn't the clearest, but I could have sworn that I heard a woman's voice. And of course, I could have heard wrong, but I'm just saying it sort of sounded like, in my opinion, that there was a woman there, but I don't know. Who knows?
I didn't hear it, but again, I'm going to have to go back now that you've said that and listen for it, and maybe I'll hear it.
Yeah.
During this call, Adam seems to be having difficulty with the address. Also, prior to checking Rebecca and cutting her down, he calls 911. It would seem logical to first check the victim, his brother's girlfriend, Rebecca, and cut her down. Like, what if she was alive? Knowing that once he called 911, even if she was alive, she'd likely be dead by the end of the call. Unless he potentially already knew she was dead.
Exactly. And this lady asks for the address like three times, and he will not tell her the address. And you know he knows it. It's very frustrating to listen to. And that's the one thing that I was referring to that would seem to be instinctual to most people. And I don't want to come off as judgmental on how people react when they see something really traumatic, but if you see someone that has hanged themselves, I feel like you'd panic and check to see if they were alive, you know, if there's any chance at all that they were, and if there was any hope left to possibly save this person, because supposedly Adam didn't know if she had just done this or if it was done earlier. So if you don't know that that person is in fact lifeless, I think 911 would be the last step when you realize there's nothing more you can do.
Right? And
maybe others' brains don't work that way, but that's just how I feel like I would be if I saw anyone, especially someone that's practically family, and they're hanging like that. I'd be doing everything while panicking, crying and screaming, I'm sure. But, you know, I'd be doing everything, hoping that with everything in me that the person, you know, is okay, or like I can make them okay. But I would be making sure that, you know, the person isn't gone. So cutting them down would be one of the first things that I feel like anybody would do in that situation.
Yes, they should. It just seems bizarre that he didn't, that he called 911. If she was alive, she would have strangled to death in that time.
Yes. Yeah. Calling 911 before even cutting her down, that's one thing that doesn't sit well with me right off the bat. And I have a theory, you know, if there was in fact someone else there, but, you know, I'll go more into that later. But yeah, you just don't call 911 and like you haven't ran over there to check or cut her down first. That just doesn't seem logical.
Like, maybe if it was a stranger, but this isn't a stranger. This is your brother's house, and this is clearly your brother's girlfriend.
Exactly.
So authorities arrive at 1043 Ocean Boulevard at the Spreckles Mansion. It doesn't take long for them to realize that they are out of their depth. They call in the San Diego Sheriff's Department to assist in the investigation. During this time, in the July heat, Rebecca's body remains there for hours, naked and in the direct sun, in view of neighbors and news helicopters. Ugh.
That makes me sick.
Right? Like, this was so upsetting for the family who would later watch the news coverage.
I mean, can you even imagine how devastating, and not to mention how disrespectful that is, you know, for the helicopters to be putting this on the news, and they're displaying a dead body of somebody that you love. You know, even if you don't know that person, I don't think that's right for the news helicopters to be filming someone that's hanging like that. I think it's disrespectful, sickening, heartbreaking. You know, I would have been probably like physically sick over that if it was especially someone that I knew. You know, I'd be so pissed.
It's just such a strange element of the case, and just the way her body was found, and then just to be left exposed like this, it just feels like there's no dignity in death for Rebecca and for Rebecca's family, and it's just so heartbreaking.
Absolutely, I agree.
The scene was bizarre from the get-go. Like, here was a woman with red bindings around her hands and feet. She had a blue t-shirt that had been in her mouth as a gag. It had been pulled out by Adam, like at the request of the 911 operator. And she had a noose around her neck, but over her hair, as well as black paint on her breasts. And she was stark naked. What really troubles me here is the noose over her hair. Even if one is wanting to commit suicide, I think it would be reflexive to pull the hair out from under the noose so that it doesn't pull and yank. Like, why make it any more painful than it has to be? As a woman with long hair, like, we always pull our hair out from under a t-shirt even. So this seems so strange to me.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head with that. And that's one thing I never thought about, but it is such a reflex and instinctual thing that those of us with long hair do. And we just do that all the time. We're constantly, if something is around our hair, we're pulling our hair out of that when we don't even know we're doing it. So if something is feeling uncomfortable or restricting on the backs of our necks and our hair is like up against it, that's one small detail that is only really the beginning of this very odd quote unquote suicide by hanging. The other detail of having a shirt shoved in her mouth, that's not something I see anyone doing to themselves.
Definitely, you know, not.
Yeah. You know, my question would be, why would you put something into your own mouth? If somebody wants to complete suicide by hanging, I think the scene would have looked completely different. You know, I know it's very awful to think about and to say, and I hate it. But yeah, in my opinion, having something in the mouth as a gag is definitely done by someone else. I don't see anybody sticking a shirt in their mouth before doing something like that. Like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, in looking at this, it just seems so theatrical and so staged and like orchestrated to look like this elaborate suicide, but it doesn't feel like an authentic suicide. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
So Angela Sueda from San Diego Sheriff's Department heads up the investigation. They search the house, and in the garage, they find the red nautical rope used for boating. Jonah Shacknai owned a speedboat, so this isn't strange. This is the same rope that had been fastened to the antique iron bed frame in the spare room where Rebecca had been found hanging. As far as other curious items that are found, there are two knives found on the ground. One is a large chef's knife. There are no fingerprints on the handle. The only fingerprints on this knife are Rebecca's, and they are found on the blade. Upon closer examination, some experts conclude that the manner in which Rebecca would have had to have been holding the knife on the blade would line up with her trying to escape bindings, which points towards murder and not suicide.
Yeah, I completely agree 100% with that. Her fingerprints would be on the handle if she were holding that knife herself. And the fact that they're only on the blade, that's a huge red flag here.
Yeah, I agree. It just seems so strange. It seems like somebody would have had to have wiped off the knife handles.
Yes. Yes.
Because there is another knife found at the scene, a steak knife, with blood on the handle and all the way up in the crevices or recesses. There is no blood found on Rebecca, except the small smear on her thigh. Remember, Rebecca was menstruating. Some experts believe that she was sexually assaulted with this knife handle, and that is the only way to explain the blood on the handle, as there was no other blood coming from Rebecca, with the exception of vaginal blood for menstruation. So it would be logical to assume that the knife handle was potentially used to assault Rebecca.
Yeah, again, those were my exact thoughts when I first heard about this case. All of these things seem so obvious and in your face that it boggles my mind that anyone would think this was a suicide. Like, nothing about it looks like a suicide at all. And I absolutely believe she was sexually assaulted with the knife handle. And it doesn't really make any sense that she would do that to herself either. I think that's completely preposterous to think that someone would do that to themselves, put a gag in their own mouth. And there's other things that I know we'll get into that point directly to this being a homicide and not suicide. But these things already, they're just not adding up. I don't know why they couldn't see that.
Yeah, it's like red flag on top of red flag on top of red flag.
Exactly.
As mentioned previously, the bath towel was just dropped on the floor as if Rebecca had been surprised by someone entering the room. It lay in a pile, and close beside it was her cell phone. It appeared to have just been dropped, not placed. If this was indeed a planned suicide, like, it seems more likely that these items would be put somewhere in a habitual manner, not simply dropped on the floor and scattered. The amount of organization needed if this was indeed a suicide would mean that Rebecca would have had to have had her wits about her to some degree. The towel dropped and the cell phone dropped appears off to me. There were also drops of blood on the carpet that we can assume are menstrual blood.
Yeah, and it seems to me that she was getting out of the shower in her towel, probably checking her phone, and then she gets into a struggle with someone, which caused her to probably drop the phone. And then I think she was sexually assaulted with the handle of the knife during this time at some point. And some may argue that the blood on the carpet was from her just being on her period. But as a woman, when I'm going through that time of the month, I mean, I feel like it's important that this discussion is had because, you know, some people may not know. And maybe it's just me, I'm not sure. But just say that I'm getting out of the shower and I'm heavily on my period. It is never dropped onto the floor. You know, it may go down my leg, but it's never dropped onto the floor. And I don't know if that's just a me thing or if anybody, have you ever experienced that before?
Okay, the only, this is rather graphic. And if there's any guys listening, please, fast forward 30 seconds if you don't want to hear this. But I think sometimes in taking out a tampon, it can go on the floor, like drops of blood can go on the floor. But in coming out of the shower, no, I've never had it just drop on the floor, just free fall. Yeah. It'll go down my leg. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think she was like, people think she might be standing there and it just drips. Like, that's not how it works. So I also just want to say, like, really quick, in my experience of attempting suicide before, years and years ago, just totally in a dark place, I put my phone down on a table and I just don't see that, you know, I wouldn't just drop my phone on the floor. That's not something that I think is even realistic to really think about. What, are you going to slam your phone down on the floor, you know, beforehand? It just doesn't make sense to me. And I don't see that being realistic in a suicide. And that's just my opinion from my experience and also knowing others who have attempted or completed suicide. I've never heard a detail such as that. So these all seem like minor details separately, but when you piece all of it together, it's just not adding up to suicide at all, in my opinion.
No, the totality of the evidence, it's so hard to remain unbiased in this case because it just screams of murder, and it just doesn't look like any suicide I've ever read about or I've ever, you know, seen on TV or anything. And even later we'll get into Dr. Cyril Wecht. He performed over, you know, 20,000 autopsies in his career. Never had he seen a woman commit suicide naked, let alone with all these strange elements.
Yes.
So it's at this point that the investigators discover the message on the back of the door of the spare room. There is a message painted in black block letters, and it says, quote, "She saved him. Can you save her?" End quote. Creepy, right?
I mean, that's just, it's very weird, and I've never been able to make this part make sense. And I don't know if this means that she saved Max. Can you save Rebecca? And what the reasoning behind that message would even mean if she wrote it that way. I mean, I don't know. I can't make sense of this really weird painted message. It's just very odd.
Yeah, I think it was on the Oxygen, like, four-part murder at the mansion. They have a psychologist come in, and she has a hypothesis that Rebecca has left her earthly body and she's not speaking about herself like in the first person anymore. And it sounded like a pretty bold claim to make. And I tend to disagree because of the other elements we find out later with regards to handwriting analysis and stuff, but that's her opinion and she's entitled to it. And it's one take on the, you know, on the bizarre message. And it's unclear. Like, we don't know what this message means. Like, if this is a strange suicide note or if this is a perpetrator staging the scene in some bizarre way, trying to point towards suicide, which is clearly where Paige and I are leaning. Like, no matter how one chooses to interpret the message, it is extremely cryptic and confusing. There are other elements that don't quite line up with Rebecca writing it herself, but we will get to that shortly. Investigators also find two paintbrushes and a tube of black acrylic paint, the same black acrylic paint found on Rebecca's breasts. What they don't find is interesting. No prints pretty much anywhere, none on the tube of acrylic, only a partial on the lid. There is an absence of fingerprints and smudges throughout the room. And we'll come back to this later, so put a pin in it.
Yeah. The message on the wall, extremely confusing to me. And when you found out about the message, like, did you interpret it? And, like, how did you interpret that message?
I think, like, if she was the one that wrote it, that I would have to side with what that psychologist had interpreted. I don't agree, but I think that that's the best interpretation that one can have, is that she was in the grip of psychosis, given, like, the psychologist basically said, look, she might have heard this message from Jonah, completely lost a grip with reality. This is someone who is feeling a great deal of guilt, and now she feels like this child may die as a result of, you know, her inaction or whatever. And then she makes a split-second decision, and also saying that suicides aren't always really planned. But there's just so, this is such a theatrical thing, every little bit of it. It just doesn't seem like a spontaneous suicide. This seems so well orchestrated and planned.
Mm-hmm. It looks very theatrical and dramatic to me, even though, yes, it is dramatic, but the way that I'll kind of explain it later, the way I feel like it's theatrical. But, you know, if she did write that message, she's not going to take the time to completely wipe away all the evidence of her fingerprints, because honestly, she wouldn't care. Am I wrong to think that? Like,
no, who, you're not care? Wrong.
Because who would care to wipe away their own fingerprints in their own suicide in a place that they're living? I mean, that makes no sense to me whatsoever.
No, it makes absolutely zero sense. Why would she be taking forensic countermeasures? Why would she care? She was beyond caring and she was ready to transition to the other side, whatever that meant for her. If she was indeed wanting to complete suicide, why would she wipe her prints away from things like the door handle, the handle of the knife? These things just, they don't make sense in my opinion.
Not at all.
So another curious item found in the room is a book on witchcraft. In the book, there are instructions on how to bind hands and feet with red rope. Only Rebecca's fingerprints were found in the book. Like, it's unclear if these are the exact knots used. I don't think that they are, and I definitely don't believe that they are, as it would have been much easier to explain away the knots if they were not so complex.
Yeah, what I've read before about these knots and how she was bound, they were knots that she not only... probably, okay, I'm not going to say it may not be impossible, but she probably would not be able to do that herself. And they are knots that people who work on boats would typically know how to do. So why would she take the time to make the knots so complicated, you know, on her hands and her feet before she allegedly hung herself? You know, I don't see how it's possible to hang yourself after you've bound your hands and your feet in that way. But to play devil's advocate just for 1 second, just say, if she had been standing on a stool and the rope was already around her neck as she was making these complicated knots for whatever reason and then kicked the stool. But as far as I know, there was nothing such as a stool or something she could have stood on that indicated that she did that. So if I'm wrong, I know you'll explain it to me more, but that's just my thinking at this point based off of the little bit that I know about this case.
No, you're not wrong. There's nothing that really explains this. And the complexity of these knots, like both on her hands and feet, this, why would you even bind your feet? Like, we'll get into this more as we go. It just makes no sense.
Yeah.
Okay, this is where we're going to end part one. Part two will be available in 2 days. Thank you. Until next time, stay safe and remember, accept nothing, question everything.